This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. It's been promised for years. Now, finally, the federal government's released its draft religious discrimination bill. It's aimed at giving better protection to people of faith, and the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, will personally introduce it into Parliament tomorrow. It's weaker than what was originally promised in an effort to appease anger on both sides of the heated debate. Here's political reporter Melissa Clark.
It has been years and several drafts in the making, but the Coalition is hopeful this version of a religious discrimination bill will do. It's a compromise, but one that the Australian Christian Lobby is satisfied with. Spokeswoman Wendy Francis.
I'd say that overall we're actually encouraged, and I think people of faith in Australia can be encouraged.
The Australian Christian Lobby has been one of the most vocal groups about the need for better protection for people of faith expressing their beliefs. A provision that would protect someone from being sacked for expressing any religious belief, the so-called Israel Folau Clause, has been removed, deemed too controversial. But the bill would mean that expressing a statement of belief cannot be discriminatory, provided it's not malicious or would threaten, intimidate, harass or vilify.
There is protection for people making statements of faith that are not vilifying, and that's a really good move.
It does allow statements of belief that are offensive. Anna Brown from Equality Australia, an LGBTIQ plus advocacy organisation, says some offensive statements are discriminatory and federal laws should not protect such speech.
When they say things like a nurse says to a patient with HIV, that their HIV is a punishment from God, for example. Or when a waiter says to a queer woman of faith in a cafe that her relationship is an abomination against God. So these sorts of statements, which could arguably constitute discrimination today and could constitute a statement of belief, and would be protected under the law under this bill.
The bill also has exemptions from anti-discrimination laws for religious bodies. Religious schools can require students and staff to practice that religion and give preference to employing people of the same faith, so long as that's made publicly clear at the time of hiring. But there are still concerns this will allow religious schools to expel students who come out as gay or leave their faith. The bill would override state-based laws, which could mean less protection in Tasmania, the ACT and potentially Victoria. But Bilal Ralph from the Australian National Imams Council says it would mean more protection in New South Wales.
If they are discriminated against because of their religious identity or because they happen to be fasting, for instance, then there is very little to nothing that they can do. And that is an extraordinary situation in modern-day pluralistic Australia, where we have a very diverse society.
Prime Minister Scott Morrison will introduce the bill to the House of Representatives this week, but it's unlikely to come to a vote in the Senate until next year. The issue has been politically charged, having been promised to faith communities by the Coalition in the wake of the same-sex marriage debate. The Prime Minister made it an election promise. Now he's under pressure to deliver on that promise in the limited time left before the next election.
Melissa Clark reporting there. And coming up on RM Breakfast after 7:30, Fran Kelly interviews the Leader of the Opposition in the Senate, Penny Wong. Hobart, again, is on the top of this list, though it's not really something to brag about. Tassie Capital's the least affordable city in Australia to find a place to rent, according to a new report out this morning. In fact, housing affordability is now worse than what it was before the pandemic in some cities, while rents are more stable in Sydney and Melbourne. Isabel Masali reports.
Rebecca Lafferty's got about a month left on the lease for her Perth apartment, and she's struggling to find somewhere else to live.
It's stressful because you've got to be like, oh, okay, you know, I've got to go here, I've got to go there. Where am I going to be next year? I just need a roof over my head.
The 33-year-old's been on the hunt for a new home since April when she was told her apartment was being sold. She's not working while she waits for knee surgery, but with her savings and a job on the way, her budget is about $310 a week, which doesn't seem to be going far.
I do have fantastic references. I have never been blacklisted and I'm a clean freak. But didn't think it was going to be this bad, this rental crisis.
On the other side of the country in Hobart, real estate agents like Sarah Woolley are being inundated by tenants.
We put on an affordable little two-bedroom unit in Sandy Bay, and just out of our prospective tenant database, there was over 300 inquiries.
Demand has surged during the pandemic, and she believes that's made Hobart no longer affordable for the average person.
There is a high number of mainland inquiry coming through at the moment. I just think it's a really hard market, and it's hard on all sides.
The latest annual report on rental affordability has once again found Hobart is the least affordable city, with the average household spending 34% of their income on rent. At the other end of the scale, Melbourne is the most affordable, followed by Sydney. And Perth has recorded the most drastic change from most affordable to third place. Adrian Pisarski is the Executive Officer of National Shelter, one of the groups behind the report.
Over the last 4 to 5 years, particularly in Melbourne and Perth, but in other major cities, we'd seen some improvement in rental affordability. All of that has been wiped out by the last 12 months. Particularly for lower income households, we've seen that the job seeker supplement and the additional income support arrangements that were put in place, which lifted them in many cases to an affordable level, have now gone and the rents have gone up.
Adrian Pisarski says the tough rental markets also highlight the desperate need for more social housing.
Social housing actually puts a floor under the whole housing system. If we don't have enough of that, we get high pressure into the rental markets. Beyond that, we need to immediately increase Commonwealth rent assistance so that renters just have more money in their pockets.
A spokesman for the Federal Housing Minister, Michael Sukar, says he can't comment on a report the government hasn't seen.
Isabel Massali reporting there. School groups in Tasmania say they've been blindsided by the Premier's surprise announcement that he'll consider delaying the start to the school year to allow primary school students to get vaccinated against COVID-19. Parents say they have been consulted and teachers want some clarity about what the rules will be, as Bridget Fitzgerald reports.
The news that there might be a delay to the start of Tasmania's school year next year caught a lot of people off guard.
Well, the first thing was, why weren't we consulted? Because it will have huge impacts.
Nigel Jones is the secretary of the Tasmanian Association of State School Organisations, or TASO, which represents parents, students and school communities across the state. What he was unaware of was that the Premier, Peter Gutwin, is considering holding off on sending primary school students back to the classroom if there's a COVID-19 vaccine approved for 5 to 11-year-olds before term one begins, to give families a chance to get their kids inoculated. The Tasmanian Catholic Schools Parents Council and the Tasmanian Principals Association also confirmed to the ABC they weren't told of the plans. Nigel Jones says schools and parents need to be kept in the loop.
Do they have to take time off work? Do they have to get some sort of carer in? It has ramifications on a whole range of things within families.
Has TASO as an organisation, or you know, parents more generally, had clear indication from the state government about what the rules will be in schools to deal with COVID?
No, there has been no full clarity to how 2022 will look like.
The full reopening of Tasmania's border from December 15 means the state is preparing for more COVID-19 to be circulating in the community. Sarah Courtney is the state's education minister.
I'm not going to preempt what the situation may be. However, I can assure parents across the state that as a minister responsible, we'll take all the appropriate measures based on public health advice.
Paediatrician and director of the National Centre for Immunisation Research and Surveillance, Professor Christine McCartney, says schools in other parts of the country are proving COVID-19 can be managed.
The experience in New South Wales, Victoria and the ACT is really strong. Children are in school now, and they're in school in the context of teachers being vaccinated, staff members vaccinated, family members from the age of 12 and above taking up vaccine to a high level of coverage, which is really an outstanding outcome.
Professor McCartney says while children may contract COVID-19, they generally only have mild symptoms. Long COVID and inflammatory illnesses are also a consideration, but she says the risk remains low.
I think it's important though for parents, families to have confidence that we know children aged 5 to 11 can attend school safely even in the absence of vaccination.
Paediatrician Professor Christine McCartney, ending Bridget Fitzgerald's report. Just days before the first public hearings of the Royal Commission into Defence and Veterans Suicide, the inquiries had to acknowledge a potential conflict of interest involving the boss of the RSL. Official correspondence obtained by the ABC reveals one of the commissioners has had to declare a long-standing social connection. The two men have now promised to cease contact during the inquiry. Here's Defence correspondent Andrew Green.
In 2 days, the long-awaited Royal Commission into Defence and Veteran Suicide will officially open in Brisbane.
We need to know that we have people that really want to investigate why our veterans are dead and dying.
Adelaide mother Julianne Finney has fought for years for the wide-ranging inquiry into the high numbers of Australian military personnel taking their own lives.
My name's Dave Finney and I'm a Petty Officer Marine Technician.
Her son Dave died by suicide after medically discharging from the Navy in 2017. Earlier this year, the National President of the RSL, Greg Mellick, was forced to apologise to Julianne Finney for private comments questioning her motivations for lobbying for this inquiry. And now a letter sent to Miss Finney by the Royal Commission acknowledges one of its three commissioners has a long-standing social connection to the head of this country's largest veterans organisation. It states the former Queensland Supreme Court Judge James Douglas has known Greg Mellick for many years and that the commissioner's brother and the RSL boss once owned a vineyard together. However, the letter says the commissioner and RSL president have now agreed to have no contact during the inquiry. Julianne Finney, though, is concerned there may be other undeclared conflicts of interest associated with the Royal Commission.
What we need is independence and transparency at a time where I have proven time and time again that this government has spun me and not told me the truth and attempted to keep up with the cover-ups.
In a statement, a spokeswoman for the Royal Commission says it does not publish details about personal associations, but information about potential organisational conflicts of interest are on its website. And the statement adds,
the Royal Commission is committed to the integrity of this process and is confident all appropriate declarations have been made and acted upon. This is vital to maintain public confidence in the important work of the Commission.
Andrew Gee is the Veterans Affairs Minister and he's expressed full confidence in the Royal Commission process.
If anyone has any concerns, they should raise them with the Commission and they will be dealt with. I'm very confident of that, but I am very confident also in the work of the Commission and I don't think anyone should have any concerns about that because all of the commissioners are people of the highest standards and integrity.
Witnesses to the Royal Commission into Defence and Veteran Suicide will begin giving evidence in public hearings on Monday.
Andrew Green, and if this story has raised concerns for you or anyone you know, Open Arms offers support for current and former Defence Force members and their families. You can call on 1800 011 046. Europe is facing a fourth COVID wave. Dutch hospitals have become so full that patients are being sent to other countries for treatment. The World Health Organization says COVID-19 is becoming the leading cause of death in the region, and it's predicting the virus could claim hundreds of thousands of lives over the northern winter. Europe correspondent Isabella Higgins has more.
The streets of the Netherlands are quiet with the country back in partial lockdown. The measures are trying to slow surging COVID infections and help hospitals already under strain. Ambulances are being stretched as the country records 23,000 new daily infections. Non-emergency procedures are being cancelled, and to try and ease the load on full intensive care wards, two COVID-19 patients had to be sent across the border to Germany for treatment. The Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte says residents are not adhering to social distancing guidelines.
It's very important that in the coming days we see a change in how basic measures are followed. And that's why I'm calling on everybody to stick to them.
The Netherlands' new lockdown laws make it difficult for the unvaccinated to go to work or to any indoor venues. 19-year-old trainee nurse Anna Pereira says the new laws forced her to get the vaccine.
Because if you're not vaccinated, people are just going to look at you okay, so you're not vaccinated. Just put your mask on and just go sit away. And that's what kind of feels like.
The World Health Organization's European Director Hans Kluge urged all nations to ramp up their vaccine efforts. Many wealthy Western European countries like Germany, Austria and Switzerland have vaccination rates below 70% of the population. Several European countries have curbed the freedoms of the unvaccinated, sparking huge protests across the continent this weekend. The WHO is warning that there will likely be hundreds of thousands of further COVID deaths in Europe in the coming months. It predicts 49 out of 53 countries will experience extreme stress in their intensive care units. France's health minister, Olivier Véran, warned things were becoming very serious.
Aujourd'hui, on va annoncer 30 000 cas de COVID sur 24 heures.
We're going to announce 30,000 COVID cases over the past 24 hours. It's a major increase in infections that shows we are indeed in the midst of a fifth wave of the epidemic. It is therefore urgent to get vaccinated and to get your booster shot when necessary.
France's double-jabbed Prime Minister Jean Castex has tested positive for COVID-19 but says his symptoms are mild. His diagnosis was just hours after a meeting with his Belgian counterpart, forcing the Belgian Prime Minister Alexander De Croo into self-isolation. Health officials say he should have been practicing better social distancing and urge other Europeans to take the new wave of infection seriously. This is Isabella Higgins in London reporting for AM.
Getting a pet has been popular during the pandemic, and that's increased the demand for vets. Many are now suffering from the pressure of long hours. Up to 30% of veterinarians are quitting within 5 years of entering the industry, and leaders are now calling for the government's support to turn that around. Annie Guest filed this report.
Come on, boys. Come here. Sit. Good boy. Good girl. It's a full house with cats and dogs of every shape and size. Never a dull moment in this house, but it's heaps of fun.
This Brisbane animal lover would do almost anything for her three cats and four dogs, who all live inside her home.
Their family. Anything they need comes first, and I'd give absolutely anything to get them the care that they need.
But all this devotion comes at a cost. Owners are expecting the latest in diagnostics and treatments, even 24-hour pet hospitals. After 30 years in the industry, Dandenong Ranger's vet, Moss Siddle, has never been busier. Today, he's treated anxious and arthritic animals, checked lumps, given vaccinations, and also...
dog that had inflammatory bowel disease, another little dog that was irritated and had an abscess. I also saw a chicken today. I saw a chicken that had been attacked by a fox. Then there was Daxie that had eaten the chocolate. An old cat that had kidney failure.
Dealing with difficult animals is one thing, but what he finds harder is copping abuse from their owners.
We can cop the brunt of the high finances that people have expended on their pet. You know, if you really cared for my pet, then it wouldn't cost so much, you know. It's hard not to take that personally because, you know, put in all that time, stayed up all night trying to get the poor dog through.
The Australian Veterinary Association says long hours and low pay are driving 30% of vets from the industry within 5 years of graduation. The president, Dr. Warwick Vale, says vets have long had a higher suicide rate than the general population.
We're seeing a workforce crisis at the moment.
A recent survey of 2,500 vets found the profession wants shorter working hours and better conditions.
It's fast heading to a state at the moment where the profession is not viable, and that's going to threaten clinical and veterinary services across the country if we continue on the pathway that we are. We just want government to help us get off that pathway. Well, we know we have to help ourselves, but we need the community and government support to help us.
And that government support could be offering tax rebates for pet insurance, akin to private health insurance for people.
That would help the sustainability of the profession. It would help remove some of those factors around anxiety and distress and a conflict around pricing and people's affordability.
It's an idea that the Veterinary Association is now planning to take to the federal government.
Annie Guest with that report, and that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Stephen Smiley.
And I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal.
Native forest logging in Victoria has less than a decade left to run, but as the timber supply dwindles, the state government's logging business Vic Forests has been found to be clearing in protected areas, including the habitat of endangered species. And now the company is facing new allegations.
Today on The Signal, a special investigation by the ABC into whether logging in Victoria could threaten Melbourne's water supply. Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.